You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Just a reminder that Big Mood, Little Mood with Daniel M. Lavery happens twice a week. Slate Plus members get an additional mini episode or Little Big Mood every Friday. Sign up now to listen at slate.com/mood. Hello and welcome back to Big Mood, Little Mood. I'm your host, Daniel M. Lavery, and with me in the studio this week is Carmen Rita Wong, the author of the recently published Why Didn't You Tell Me, a memoir. Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Danny, for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I am immensely looking forward to it, and I've just realized that our third letter could potentially solve our first letter, because the first letter is about dealing with somebody who's having a mental health crisis. And the next letter is about how to handle a colleague who is always armchair diagnosing people. And I wonder if we can just get that person involved in the first one, tell everyone what their diagnosis is, sort them all out.
Oh, solve the problem completely. Like magic. Yeah. Wave a wand.
I love that. Okay. That's what we're going to do. I think this is going to be great. From now on, I'm going to be answering questions with an eye towards causing as much chaos as possible.
Oh.
And so I will assign people from certain letters to handle other letters on my behalf. I will deputize them.
Oh my
gosh.
And
I will send in agents of chaos.
That is very chaotic. Then we'll have follow-up.
Oh God, that would be an amazing show. I would definitely listen to that, but I don't think that I'm up for doing that. Well, I hope that you are feeling, you know, just incredibly bolstered and your truest self, because we've got some problems to help people solve today. Are you feeling bolstered and like your truest self? Because if not, you should let me know now.
Oh, let me tell you, Danny, never in my life have I felt more my truest self. So you got me at a good time.
All right. Okay. Let's dance, baby.
Yes.
Would you read our first letter?
Sure. Okay. So the first one is, I'm the youngest of six siblings. I'm in my 50s, living in different cities. My older brother, Barry, lives in Seattle, and our closest sibling is a five-hour drive away. Barry was hospitalized twice for paranoid delusions in the early 2000s. He recovered and was able to get a great job and stay married. But about 6 years ago, his psychiatrist encouraged him to discontinue his meds. Since then, he's spiraled. He's divorced and believes his ex-wife was trying to kill him. She wasn't. Has lost his job. And since 2019 has believed that the rest of his siblings are, quote, microdosing him. We're worried, but haven't been able to do much. This week, Barry's ex forwarded us a foreclosure notice. He's going to be foreclosed upon within 30 days. He hasn't paid his mortgage since the spring, and the bank wants $24,000 immediately. A family friend who works with a mental health agency is trying to get a lawyer to help slow the process. We feel the best case scenario is that we postpone the foreclosure, sell the house, pay off the debt, and then try to get him into some kind of housing. But that's a difficult prospect if Barry won't speak to us. His phone is disconnected. Thoughts?
So I can also slightly remove the pressure from this one because it's kind of intense. Just by letting you know, this letter is more than 30 days old. So
yeah.
It's from September. I'm working through a backlog of questions. So enough time has passed that like the immediate crisis, like what either they managed to work something out with the bank or they didn't. Generally speaking, if you've got lawyers and family friends and mental health agencies kind of able to help you out, it's likely that they were able to at least buy themselves a little bit more time. But it's also certainly possible that they're in like a very different situation now.
I hope so. I hope they were able to reach him, because I've dealt with this myself with a mentally ill family member, and you try to help and help and help. But if they're not ill enough to be put away by other people, meaning that you have the legal ability to get them help, they are treated as adults, even if they are very mentally ill. And that means sometimes you just can't help as much as you'd like.
Yeah. And I think specifically, one of the limits that you might need to be working with is, my kind of limited layman's understanding, as well as some like background investigating into like the British Columbia Schizophrenia Society and a couple of other experts in the field. My understanding is that it's generally not encouraged that you try to argue with someone in an active delusion. Mm-hmm. That usually, just by like laying out the facts and trying to explain, no, I promise no one's microdosing you, does not actually enable somebody who is, dealing with delusions to say, oh, I recognize this logic. Thank you. I no longer have the delusion.
Oh, right. Yeah, correct. I mean, this is not logical.
Yeah. So hopefully the letter writer and her siblings have been able to try at least to make contact without trying to argue too fine a point.
Yeah.
But that does, of course, limit your ability in some ways, because if you try to talk to him, even if you try to establish a rapport, don't try to contest his delusions, but like stress that you want him to be safe and taken care of, mm-hmm. Especially if it's a specific goal, like, I think, it would be good for you to talk with your psychiatrist right now. Do you think that they would be helpful?
Yeah. Can we talk about that psychiatrist for a second?
Well, and I'm curious.
Because that angered me so much.
I was curious whether or not that was like, I was wondering, like, did Barry say my psychiatrist told me to go off my meds?
Right.
Or did Barry decide to go off of his meds and then among his other delusions believed that his psychiatrist had encouraged him to do so?
Yes. Yes. I mean, those are the questions,
that was my
right?
suspicion, really. Mm-hmm. Was like, I'd be a little bit surprised if the psychiatrist actually said that.
Because that would be, oof. No.
Yeah. I mean, again, I also don't know, like maybe there were really debilitating side effects. Maybe the psychiatrist had suggested replacing it with a new medication that Barry then didn't. Like there was just too many possibilities there for me to feel like definitely rule out whoever the psychiatrist, because maybe there's a new psychiatrist. I don't know. Anyways, lots of open-ended questions, but certainly I think it would be useful to at least encourage a doctor's appointment of some kind. And so I feel like one possible strategy could be hearing Barry out and saying, like, with all that's going on, do you think it would help you to see a doctor or talk to one of the medical professionals that you do have a relationship with without contesting the delusion? But again, if he thinks you're trying to poison him and you try to have this conversation, even where you're being pretty restrained in terms of any interventions you offer, if he ultimately decides just like, I don't trust you, don't talk to me, I'm not able to listen to you, That might be itself a limiting factor. You might not be able to push past that right now. And that might be difficult. And I think that's part of why I wanted to encourage this letter writer to also really like lean on their siblings for support, try to figure out together how you can look out for one another if the first move is rebuffed and you have to stand back and know he's going to lose the house and there's not much we can do about it.
Yeah, it's rough. I have an uncle who's paranoid schizophrenic that I've been kind of working on and off with most of my life. And even now, the one thing that has helped, he decided at one point to go off of his meds and things got very bad. And what happened was I can talk to his social worker and his social worker can talk to me. And then I encourage him to see her, to talk to her, to get on his meds. And a lot of it is just having those conversations, not necessarily even in person, but it is that kind of gentle guiding that you say, like that gentle, like, let's go get some help. Like, we really just want you to feel better, and not arguing those points because the delusions are real to them.
Yeah.
So it's just really about guiding them to the people that are going to help. And in terms of, I really hope they were able to get a hold of him, of course.
Right. I imagine that would have involved at least 1 5-hour drive.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like he has like a really rich network of friends in the area if he like has separated from his ex. And, again, I think the letter had said at one point, I might have edited this for time, in which case I apologize, but mentioned that it was pretty acrimonious, the divorce. So I don't know.
I assumed.
Yeah. I
assumed.
My guess was there weren't a lot of like really close friends of Barry's that the siblings could kind of tap into in the area. But certainly if there are any even just like friendly former coworkers that you could maybe ask to check in with him, I'd encourage you to do that. But my guess is probably you won't be able to get much help from the ex-wife, if only because he thinks you're only microdosing him, but he thinks she's trying to kill him. So he'll probably be a lot more resistant to any attempted contact by her.
Yeah. And she's the one who forwarded the foreclosure notice. And I get the language, like, forwarded us a foreclosure notice. She didn't like call and talk it through. And
right.
Let's
that lady's
we can help.
Tired.
You know, I was like, she is done.
She is very, very done.
Sister is done. Yeah. Mental illness is very difficult, especially as siblings, you know, and family members. It's, you can feel very, very guilty and responsible, but there's only so much you can do. So I just encourage this letter writer to not feel completely awful about not necessarily finding success right away and just kind of gently keep at it.
Yeah. I will, in the show notes, I'll post a link to just a sort of like really basic primer that the BCSS has about like, how do I have a conversation with somebody I love who's experiencing delusions in a way that is like maximally helpful? And so there's just kind of, you know, a long list about, you know, different ways about like not arguing, ways that you can try to establish some trust, try to redirect towards certain small incremental goals, things to avoid. None of that's like a recipe for getting what you want out of somebody in a single perfect conversation, but that might prove helpful for you and your siblings, as well as, you know, if you're able to talk to on your own time, a psychiatrist or a mental health professional that you trust, not necessarily that you need to all go get therapists, but just like, I have a sibling who experiences paranoid delusions. What should I be prepared for? How can I be most helpful? Just getting any sort of tips from anyone who's an expert in the field. Because sometimes you might think like, I'll just go in there and like use my common sense or just try to remind my sibling of who they used to be. And that might feel intuitive in the moment, but can actually be counterproductive. And so I want to try to help them from, I don't know. I just remember I used to watch like Hoarders all the time in like college.
Yes.
And
yes.
Their like mental health help was always somebody who would basically just show up and be like, you should really throw your stuff away.
Oh.
And then would like throw a bunch of stuff away and they'd be like incredibly agitated and distressed. And they would just be like, but you got to throw it out. And
talk
like,
about
obviously
it.
That's,
talk about a Band-Aid. That's terrible.
That's like reductive.
Yeah,
I'm sure that there
terrible.
Were some people on the show who did their best, but it really felt like they were just being like, oh, you should throw out your stuff. And it was like, well, if that was going to help, that would have helped a while ago. This is not appropriate mental health treatment.
Which is why all those shows actually really bothered me. Because it was very much about the production as opposed to, you know, the help. And but for this letter writer, though, I would also recommend, you know, having gone through this myself, what really helped was if you can track down whoever he's getting treatment from.
Yeah.
Even in the past. And I know that there, of course, are doctor-patient
confidentiality. There's HIPAA laws, right? Yeah, you're not going to be able to just call up and be like, hey, do you treat this guy?
But as direct family members, you can see, you know, speak with someone who has treated him or is treating him, and they can at least guide you, like you're saying that you're posting, you know, how to talk to this person, how best to get, you know, him to get more help as such. They can do that. And it's very helpful because they know them a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, certainly I hope that your family friend found that lawyer. I hope that's been useful. I imagine you're probably not going to get a best case scenario out of this. Maybe you are. That would be wonderful. But I think it's good to have a couple of medium and worst case scenarios that you can plan for. And that will include, you know, letting yourself grieve or express like your own frustrations or your own stress as you try to help deal with this from afar, because that's really challenging. So
yeah.
I hope you're all able to find ways to look after yourselves and to try to figure out like, how do I, you know, help deal with my brother in like a chronic and ongoing way where I'm not going to be able to solve this probably ever. And he will probably deal with delusions to some degree or another for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do best case scenarios look like given that kind of feedback? And what will I do if my sister drives down and is rebuffed, or if one of us flies out and is rebuffed? How will I, you know, grieve that? And then also let go of some of the hopes that were totally reasonable. None of this is to say like, you know, you've been dreaming too big. Like, it's really understandable that you would hope that you could try to recoup some of the significant financial loss that your brother is having to experience. But it's also, I think, just useful to live as close to reality as you can in terms of just like, there might be a lot of money that we're never going to see again, that Barry's never going to see again.
It can be very expensive. Though, of course, it depends, because they could make it his financial responsibility and then they can help him outside of that. Meaning, so make the what's due the banks, you know, responsibility. But I'll say this. I hope his life before he got off those meds sounded pretty good. Meaning he had the job, you know, he was married. It seemed like that's when things really fell apart. You know, it can be managed. So if he gets that help, he could pull his life together. And as long as he knows, you know, this letter writer can let him know that you're there for him. I know he thinks, you know, you're microdosing. There's all of those things, but something can get through for sure.
Well, and that's the thing I think is like you try. And then if you're not able to on this go around, you know, leave the door open. Hope that at some point in the future, you can try again. You know, if you can't call him right now, find a time when you might be able to try to visit. If that's not possible right now, let one of your closer siblings get out there and see if there's a way you can help. I don't know, pay for some of the gas.
Yeah.
Call them before and after, you know, to help support them. If one thing doesn't work, wait, recover a little, try something. Like, get in this one for the long haul. I agree, it would be wonderful if he were able to, you know, make another appointment with his medical team. If he could be encouraged to try his medication again. Again, my guess is it's pretty challenging. And for good reason, it is pretty challenging to involve the state in getting someone to take medication against their will.
But maybe he can be encouraged to go back on. I know that, you know, that worked for my uncle, but it takes time. It takes time and trust. But teaming up together as a family is always a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially I think spreading the word with the other siblings of making sure everyone's on the same page of, if we do get FaceTime with Barry, please don't spend that time trying to argue with him about the delusions. That doesn't mean if he accuses you of something, you have to say, yes, I did it. But like, don't make jokes about it. Sometimes people want to do kind of gallows humor stuff about it. And that's really not advised when, again, if this is like you are with your other siblings venting afterwards at a diner, you can do gallows humor if you need to, but when you are with him, don't make jokes about any of the delusions. Don't dismiss them. Don't say, yes, I'm doing this. You can like generically affirm, I care about you. I really want you to be safe. You're safe with me now. I can commit. I'm not going to hurt you. I don't want to hurt you. Those are all things that you can safely do and say. But yeah, making sure you're all on the same page is going to be hugely important, because if like three of you are, and then one of you is just like, no, I've got to fight with him about this. I've got to disagree.
The disruptor in the family. Yeah.
Right. Then that will make things a lot harder. And so making sure you're on the same page will be crucial, I think.
For sure. For sure.
And good luck. I'm really, really sorry. This is really, really challenging.
And it can be like a lifelong thing. And I tried to take care of my uncle, and another family member got involved and kind of blocked me from helping. So that can happen too, to your point of like, if there's that one family member that's not on the same page, that can really just throw everybody's plans out the window. So try as you can and, you know, lead with love and information. Get as much information as you can on what he's struggling with and who he's dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's it. And you know, if anyone listening is a mental health professional with any particular expertise in talking to somebody who's experiencing delusions, please certainly write and let us know other suggestions that you might have, other things that you would encourage letter writers like this to bear in mind. Not necessarily just this one scenario, but just generally speaking, because I think there's lots of like sort of like generally disseminated like stuff on like social media that's like how to talk to someone with depression. It's like, yeah, I know that one. What about delusions?
That's more rare.
Yeah, let's get that one. Let's get that one circulating, please.
Yes. And in some ways, a little bit more pressing, because that gets, you know, it gets into, if you do the wrong thing, it can have worse consequences in some ways. Because delusions are strong. Delusions are reality to them. So,
yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So now, kind of on the other end of things, the other side of this coin, Our next letter is about somebody who sees diagnoses everywhere and is ready to hand them out to anyone. You don't even have to ask. Just here, have one. And so the letter writer is trying to figure out how to deal with this armchair diagnoser. And I love that this is in the real estate industry, because I think real estate agents are absolutely bananas. Like, they combine,
oh my gosh, yeah,
they combine the weirdness of like small business owners and like deranged entrepreneur culture with like landlord shit.
Mm-hmm.
So you just get like some real messiness. And as I think I had occasion to say recently, because I saw a bunch of posters of them, I was like, I think the strongest force in nature is a mother-daughter real estate team, because always like putting ads where they're standing back to back and they're like matching pantsuits, like arms crossed, and they're just like,
I know one, and it's,
do you really?
It's scary. Yeah.
Oh,
very successful,
fight,
but it's,
it is
a little terrifying. Let's just put it this way. I wouldn't want to be going against them in any way in terms of a sale.
I would do anything, but like if I crossed the path of a mother daughter real estate team, like I would just be like, my goal is to get out of this situation alive. I'm not going to disagree with anything they have to say. If they tell me to like kill my best friend, I'll be like, you got it. And then like leave and try to find out a way to get out of it. But I'm not going to say so.
Made of steel.
So now everyone knows my weakness, mother-daughter real estate teams.
Ah, now I know.
I will read this letter before I reveal any more of my weaknesses. Subject is armchair expertise. I have a colleague who likes to diagnose people as if she's a psychologist. She's a real estate agent. She talks to a psychologist friend of hers about all the people in her life in order to diagnose them by proxy, then tells these people what's wrong with them based on her diagnosis. She doesn't even know most of these people very well, so of course she makes many inaccurate and unfair assumptions about them. She's done this for years. Many other colleagues have commented about it, but we don't really know how to escape it. I try to minimize the time I spend with her, and I definitely don't share anything personal. But aside from cutting the entire relationship loose, is there any other way to address this? I was curious. Did you get a sense from this letter that she's like diagnosing other people in the office? Or like when people are like, I have a house to sell, she's like, you're a narcissist.
Oh, I think she's doing it for everyone.
Just everybody.
Everyone. Danny, folks like this, you know that they do it. They could be in line in the grocery store and the checkout person and be like, let me tell you what she did. And this is what she is. You know, that was OCD behavior. And it's so awful.
I don't think I know anyone quite like this. I mean, I have known people who have been like slightly inclined to armchair diagnose an ex or two or a parent or two, but they usually have confined it to that. They don't, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's like, I diagnose people a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm a little, I have to admit this, I'm a little intrigued, and I hate to say it, but I think if she were my colleague, I would maybe for my own amusement, encourage her to share a lot of these diagnoses with me and maybe even egg her on because I thought it was funny.
Until the mirror is turned on you, and
no,
then
until,
you know,
exactly. Until
and then and you're gonna be like, "Woman, you don't know anything."
No, that would blow up in my. That would blow up in my face so bad. I would be involved in so much interpersonal conflict. I would deeply regret my bad behavior. So don't do that, letter writer.
No, but you know the people that I have known who have come close to this, they, you know, who tend to do this sort of thing, not real estate agents, actually. Like when I was in graduate school in psychology, like this is like one of those things that the grad students do, right? It's just kind of like doctors, you know, going to med school and trying to diagnose everything or thinking they have everything. But to that point, it sounds to me, folks like this, a lot of these folks actually are unsure of themselves very much. And it's a lot of projection. And
control. Like take her on a self-esteem retreat until she feels good enough that she stops doing it?
No. It's she needs to look inward, sister, inward, because all of that out is the signal that she's not looking where she should be looking, which is inside.
I guess I think the thing that's so curious to me is I would feel like if, because it doesn't sound like she's giving people flattering diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, oh, yes, you are like very interesting and complicated. Like she's not telling everyone they're indigo children. And I feel like since so much of like the real estate industry has to do with at least like at least like a shallow veneer of like warmth and approachability, I feel like that would really limit her ability to sell a lot of house. I don't know, if I was trying to like buy a house and my real estate agent was just like, oh, heads up, I think you have all kinds of DSM-6 in you, I'd be offended. And I would maybe just say like, what an odd thing to say. Don't buy me a house. That's not how real estate agents work. You know what I mean? So I was wondering, like, why aren't more people just like saying to her face, fuck you?
Like, why would she tell people? Like, I understand if you're doing it as kind of like this, you know, very kind of sick game, whereas like you're in the office and you're bored. And so you start diagnosing people that you deal with, but not to their faces.
Right.
You do it, you know, but to tell people what's wrong with them, my child, you are going to not do well in life because one day she's going to come up against somebody who is going to tell her what's what.
Ideally, she'll come up against somebody who also armchair diagnoses people and tells her what diagnosis has led her to do all the improper armchair diagnosing, and then they can just have a battle.
Well, I tell you, it would be an ugly scene, Danny, if somebody came up to me and tried to knew me for 5 minutes and tried to tell me, you know, you did that, and you know what? You're this. And I'd be like, excuse me. Oh, let me tell you, Dominican mama face would come on so fast and, you know, probably burn you to the ground. It's not good. But in terms of the advice as to like how to deal with this person, people sometimes are just so afraid of conflict that it's, as you know very well, that it's they're willing to just let go of the relationship, even if it is a relationship they need to have professionally. And so just kind of saying, you know, I noticed you like to do this. It's not, maybe it doesn't go, you know, why? And then kind of be curious about why this person is doing this and try to get at the root of it. And it might be a self-esteem issue, which is, I'm assuming, and a control issue and trying to make, you know, be above. Because when you can say you're this and you're that, then it's like you're putting yourself above folks. But to get at and have a talk about like, look, I'm trying to help you professionally, right? I'm trying to really help you professionally here. This is not going to go well. Mm-hmm. But somehow to approach it without, you know, bad conflict. I'm feeling like maybe there's fear here in terms of actually talking about it.
Right. I was like, does she sell the most houses or something? Like, why are you, because the thing to me is like, she alienates a lot of people. So to me, I would feel like, what's there to be afraid of? Like, if she gets mad at you, no one's going to be on her side. No one's going to be like, oh, you really should have let her keep doing that. So I would say like, maybe you have a lot of options. Certainly you can just ignore her. Like, my understanding of real estate agents is that like, you might be sort of like loosely under the same affiliation, but you don't, it's not like you rely on her to sell houses on your own necessarily. Yeah. So I think there's probably a limit to how much you need her. So like, that really opens up the playing field. You could certainly ignore her. You're not like, I don't know, it's not your job to like fix this lady. If you just want to be like, I have a weird colleague, I avoid her, that's fine. Or if you just, during one of your minimal interactions, if she does it again, you can just say like, you know, I really don't like it when you diagnose people. Please stop. Like, that's fine. You could even go further and be like, I've noticed you've been doing this for years. I think it's really weird. Why do you do this? And ask and listen. You can do that too. That's also fine. But any of those options, like,
would not take
a lot of preparation.
I've got one more for
please.
You.
Please.
This is only if you actually care about this person. So I actually do this with my young teenager because this is very like young teenage behavior, right? It's like black and white behavior. Like, you're bad. This person hates me, or this person's doing this and this person's mean and blah, blah, blah. And you say, well, why do you think they did that? To get them to put themselves in that person's shoes and be like, well, maybe she was tired. Maybe she was hungry. Maybe she was, you know, stressed out about something. Don't you get stressed out? Are you crazy? I mean, and that's a horrible thing to say to somebody because she's using words like that word, the C word, you know, she's using these words and it's negative, completely negative. But that's just something I try to do with my daughters, just kind of like, oh, it's this person and she was mean. Well, maybe she's tired. Maybe she's hungry. Maybe she's very stressed out. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with you. We all are like this at some time. And kind of making it like, it diffuses the idea that she has power to say this person is mentally ill. Like, this person is sick this way. Instead, it's, we all sick, sister. okay, we all got, you got to stop because this, it holds no weight, carries no water.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even just say like, what an odd thing to say. Like that's a kind of classic for a reason. Yeah. And then my last, because I really don't think that you should encourage her and egg her on just for the sake of shit stirring. But if you wanted to make up imaginary diagnoses and say things like, oh, I disagree. I think she has Epona syndrome. And then no more information, fake a phone call, leave the room.
Oh.
So she can't ask you, what's that? And you have to make her think, oh my God, there's a new diagnosis. And I didn't know about, my psychologist friend didn't share it with me. I'm no longer on the cutting edge of this game. And just keep one-upping her.
My man. That's oh. Rough. That's
she's got, pim- look at you she's going got Pimpillion there. Syndrome.
There. And then you know very she's going to go and like Google it. As you know, I've never heard of this. What is this? Blah, blah, blah. And you just hold your ground. Oh, hold your ground. It's
very rare. Yeah. She's got triple compulsive disorder. Yeah. Probably you won't want to do that.
No.
I like how like earlier I was like, now don't joke about somebody's delusions. Like, you know, be like calm and take things seriously. And now just for some reason, because this is a work issue, I'm just like, be maximally like a shithead.
Well, the stakes are not so high, right?
Right,
and
right.
What I love is that the first two sentences, the way it's written, it's like, who likes to diagnose people? This is just a psychologist.
Yeah.
She's a real estate agent.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's too much and it's not worth it. But if you got to work with this person, diffuse that bomb. Just diffuse
it. Tell her
to
knock it off. Just tell her it's not welcome. Like, she's at work. It's a totally reasonable thing to say, stop diagnosing people we're at work. And frankly, I think once you do it, other people are probably going to start to back you up. I really don't think you have to worry about everyone suddenly being like, no, she's wonderful. We love it when she does that.
Yes.
How
she
could you?
She gave me such insight into my own psychology.
Yeah. Oh, I learned so much about myself that day.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. No.
Well, let us know which of those options you choose and if you need more names for fake diseases, because I will happily send them to you. This also feels like kind of an appropriate moment to ask you to talk a little bit about the book, since we're talking about things like what should you disclose? What should you withhold? What do you do when you learn something that has been withheld from you for a while? And yeah, I would just love it if you could tell us a little bit about the book and how that's been going.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's been a lot in the sense of, you know, you go through the process of writing it or even just, you know, getting it sold, right? And then it goes out there and it's my fifth book, but my first memoir, of course, and hardcover and it's Crown and all that. So it was a big deal and a dream to get it done. So it's great. But talking about this issue, it's been very interesting to see what a Rorschach test my life is for readers. So my mother hid, of course, my origin story and basically told a couple of untruths, which she took to her grave. And I lived as one person for 31 years. And then I lived as supposedly another person for another 14 years. And then the truth comes out. And it all made me look at and define and redefine myself, ethnically, culturally, racially, and and who my family members are, right? But the idea too that we moved from Harlem, you know, as a Dominican Chinese, as my older brother and I are the Wongs, to New Hampshire when my mother's second husband was an Anglo-American man, to whiteness. We went from completely, you know, brown and Asian, brown, black and Asian, to a place of just whiteness where we were the only ones who weren't. That shaped me so much as well. So seeing who, you know, who the reader is, I get back different ideas of where people connect. And it's really interesting because everybody of every background connects in some way. Because Danny, it's like the question always is, as you know very well, is who am I? And we're all figuring ourselves out. Right. And you get to a certain point in life and you get to look back. And especially for me, you know, the immigrant story is not necessarily always shown as the American story, but it is very, very deeply an American story that needs to be told a lot. And because it helps everyone understand. And I've heard from people who are many generations of the United States, you know, white Americans who are just like, I had no idea this has shown me what immigrant experience is really like. And it's made me see immigrants differently. And then, you know, the Latino community, I've heard from, you know, Afro-Latinos have been like, thank you. Chino-Latinos have been like, thank you. People who have discovered who their parents are later in life, it can really rip your soul in some ways, but it can also be incredibly healing. And people have asked me, which really applies to, you know, me being a very big fan of what you do here, the idea of forgiveness or not. You know, people have asked, so you forgive your mother? Because I'm quite generous in how I write about her and my father's, with an S, multiple S's. And there are no villains, because I write about them and I answer that question, you know, why didn't you tell me, by looking at her as a person, as an individual, not as my mother, just as a person, a survivor from a very horrific childhood and regime in another country, to come here. And in that way, I found my peace, but I did not, I don't forgive. And forgiveness to me requires apology, which I haven't gotten from anyone, and a change in behavior. And everyone's had the chance to do those things and they haven't. Fine. But that's, I don't have to give them. Forgive has given it. That's why I always lean on. I'm like, has the word given it? Like, you hurt me and I'm going to give you something for what? You know, it's about them more. I see it as that way, not as the Catholic forgive. I see it as it's something you're giving someone who's hurt you. I see them as people. And let me tell you, Danny, it has brought me so much more peace and understanding as to all of my familial relationships and who my family is, not just biologically, but very much the family that I've had to create myself with my friends.
I think that's such a useful idea about decoupling forgiveness from the idea of seeing people holistically, letting go of some resentments or even moving on with your life, such that they're all different things and you might choose to do some or all of them. But it isn't just a decision between either you forgive someone or you are stuck in the sort of like primal scene, eternally wounded, never able to recover an idea of like, a self or a family or a future.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find that unfortunately, maybe it's because, you know, talk about diagnosing, being raised by narcissists, you very much, there's this idea of like, you have to forgive them, you know, and forgiveness is kind of elevated as this, like, if you don't forgive, you're a bad person. And I've spent years kind of deconstructing all of those thoughts and ways of thinking about all of this stuff, and also 15 years of weekly therapy, Danny. 15 years.
That sounds about right.
And my own graduate degree in psychology, I really, to look at, you know, how I can look at this more clearly and as myself, as opposed to the voices in my head. And I don't feel, you're not a bad person if you don't forgive someone who's hurt you, but you can see them with empathy. You can understand them and their choices, and make peace with that, that they did what they did and you are who you are and you can move on. And some people may say, well, that sounds like forgiveness. Well, call it whatever you will.
I think of it as something distinct, but yeah, I think that's partly because often people have conflated anything like healing, acceptance, moving on with forgiveness. Mm-hmm. When I think I share your understanding of forgiveness is like a pretty involved process that has to do with at least some sort of reparation of a relationship, not necessarily that you become besties, but like, it's not this totally abstract thing you do in isolation. Although, yeah, maybe somebody else feels that they do it that way. But I'm curious, you mentioned that you'd heard from a lot of different people about your experience with the book. Did you ever hear from anyone who had been in your mother's position? Or was it more either people who had been in your position or just kind of people who were curious about like your life story?
Oh, wow. Danny, that's a great question. I have not. I have not, because here's the thing, and you're saying that. No, what I hear from is I hear from adults who have found out that they have another parent. Of course, it's a father usually, or, you know, their aunt is actually their mother, that sort of thing. But I'll tell you why I think why, because as I understand from my mother and why she hid this so much. When I tell you the shenanigans, She had a couple of men, a couple of my fathers at the same time for decades, thinking that they were my father. Most of my life. Yes. And they kept it a secret too. So, you know, this woman, I do have to marvel at her skill and give props to that. But I think a lot of it, of course, has to deal with being a brown woman, a brown immigrant in this country, a woman, you know, coming from a home of abuse, and the first marriage was abusive and all this stuff. And I think this was really about survival. And then in the end, it was about curating who she was in other people's eyes and who she was in my eyes. And I definitely loved writing the last couple of chapters, because I kind of pull it together as to like how I figured out, you know, why she did what she did. And if she had told me, or I, you know, it would have all fallen apart.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of fear of losing me and a lot of fear of losing the fathers and losing face. So she had a lot to lose. But had she started out with the truth, or even, you know, said the truth before she passed, she had that chance, but she couldn't do it. You know, so I don't think I'm going to hear from people who have done this themselves, because there's so much shame involved. So much shame.
I think that makes some sense to me. It seems like that's a decision where either you feel so anxious at the idea of the truth becoming known that you're not willing to reach out to somebody who's written about the subject, even if part of you might want to. Or alternately, sometimes if you carry on in that kind of lie for long enough, you begin to believe it, and then you would not feel a need to unburden yourself or reach out to somebody who had written a book like this, because you would just feel like, I'm normal. Things are normal.
Oh, I did hear from somebody who found out that they had a different father and confronted her mother with the DNA, and the mother refused. Yeah. Said, nope, it's a lie. It's a lie. And she took the DNA test again, and it showed again. And she was like, nope, that's not right. That's not your father, even in the face of science. So there is, you know, to bring it back to delusions, you know, there is this kind of, I'm going to hold on to this so tight, because if I were to let it out, I would fall apart. My world that I have constructed would fall apart. And that is like death to some people.
Oh yeah. Don't I know it? Obviously, in many ways, it is a distinct and a different situation. But in terms of learning something new about parents relatively later in life, as well as then seeing people having to make peace with an untenable or an unlivable situation so that they continue to live with it, is itself like a pretty remarkable thing. And I think the last time that my mother attempted to contact me was probably a little over a year and a half ago, and I didn't see it directly, but it was some expression of sadness at like some sweet conversation that my brother and I had had years before, and some sadness that we weren't close now. And it just felt like really deranged.
Yeah.
Just like, there's actually an incredibly clear reason that we are not close right now.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're not able to acknowledge that in this moment is just, it's a sort of horrifying look at what you have to give up in order to live in like a really foundational kind of lie.
Yeah. Because not seeing you right here, right now, but mourning for that boy, that conversation, that other person that she has, she, you know, she has an idea. And that's the thing, is that when you lie to yourself and others, you know, about something so huge as your identity or your origin story or that sort of thing, it causes such distance. It robs you of so much. My mother and I, our relationship was so contentious for so many reasons. And I just wanted a mother to love me. But there was an idea of me instead, and I didn't fit that idea. So we both lost out. One of the pledges I've always made to myself was that, you know, that I was going to have to live in truth. And I myself came out in, what I'm going to say, in my mid-40s. As queer. And that was something that was incredibly difficult for me to do. But I had a daughter, and she made very clear at a very young age that she was queer. And she And I was like, how dare I be like my mother? How dare I? No, really. Yeah. I was like, she's brave enough to do it. And I really needed to find it myself, first of all. I knew it always, but I buried it because it was bad enough that I was a girl or woman and brown with a Chinese name. You know, it, going through life like that during the 70s and 80s and 90s was kind of brutal. So, and then doing it on TV and doing it in magazines, like it was very public.
You were like, I'm busy. I have enough.
I was busy, but I was also like, I can't manage one more mark against me that society will put on me. And I really had hoped that in college I could be myself, but there was so much racism. I was like, I can't, I just couldn't do it. And I think that that's very complicated for people of color when they, you know, are like, okay, do I come out or not? But now with this generation, like younger generation, I'm so inspired. I'm so inspired. And I was like, oh, mommy too.
Well, hell yeah. Like, we're doing this. Let's go.
And I unfortunately, I couldn't keep it in the book. I had a chapter about it. I couldn't keep the book because, you know, we were trying to really focus on the secret in the end. Mm-hmm. And my publisher was like, you know, this is also another identity that you're kind of grappling with and discovered. But we, you know, we got to focus on the, you know, the DNA part. And I was like, okay, I'll save this for something else.
Save it for the sixth book.
But it's in my heart. It's very much in my heart because it's a very important part of my identity that I, regardless of gender, I'm attracted to people regardless of gender, always have been since I was a little kid.
And when can we expect your next exciting gay book?
Oh my God,
that
me?
I've now decided you have to write. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, first I have to have an actual queer life, but mostly it's the paperback.
You heard it here first, folks. If you want to go out with Carmen, please write to me, Danny Lavery.
DMs are open. The paperback comes out in August. So right now the book is out there. I'm working on my novel, which is very exciting. And the research is wonderfully exciting, partially based in fact and quite a bit based not. But the protagonist is queer pan woman. So there you go. Maybe a little bit of me in there.
There you go. And you know, sorry for suggesting that everyone who listens to the show tries to ask you out. But I will, you know,
I can use all help I can get, Zanny, you know.
Carmen, you are just such a delight, and I hope that we get to have you back on the show sometime in the very near future. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Danny. I'm a big fan. Love what you do. Thank you for having me on.
Right back at you. Thank you for joining us on Big Mood, Little Mood with me, Danny Lavery. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/mood to sign up to subscribe or hit the subscribe button on whatever platform you're using right now. Thanks. Also, if you can, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to know what you think. If you want more Big Mood, Little Mood, you should join Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. Members get an extra episode of Big Mood, Little Mood every Friday, and you'll get to hear more advice and conversations with a guest. And as a Slate Plus member, you'll also be supporting the show. Go to slate.com/mood plus to sign up. It's just $1 for your first month. If you'd like me to read your letter on the show, maybe you need a little advice, maybe some big advice, head to slate.com/mood to find our Big Mood, Little Mood listener question form, or find a link in the description on the platform you're using right now. Thanks for listening. And here's a preview of our Slate Plus episode coming this Friday. The way you feel about your own libido is, I think, almost as important as your libido itself. Like, the difference between my libido is low, but that feels connected to menopause and I'm really miserable about it.
Yeah.
Is so, like, that description of, like, I feel like I lost part of my connection with life. I felt like part of me had
completely,
died.
Completely.
Is so different from somebody else who might have a low libido and say, I feel great about it. So I think as important as kind of trying to gauge where's my libido at is also, does that feel satisfying to me? Do I feel kind of inert and neutral about it? Do I feel pleased about it and like it enables me to focus my time and energy elsewhere? To listen to the rest of that conversation, join Slate Plus now at slate.com/mood.